Dear listener, if you like this podcast, I want to tell you about something else you might enjoy as well. Every week, I host an online meetup. In each meeting, I give a presentation on some programming topic, or I bring a guest to the group for a discussion, or I do a code review on a member's code base, or I do some kind of consultation with one of our members. Coming to this meetup is kind of like listening to this podcast, except it's live and interactive, which means you get a chance to ask questions and participate in a conversation with other programmers like yourself. The meetup is also a fun place to meet some new friends. To learn more and to sign up, visit codewithjason.com/meetup. Now on to the episode. Hey, today I'm here with Matt Swanson. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hello, hello.
So this is, I think, our third attempt or second attempt at recording this podcast episode, but I think we're going to get it right this time.
Yeah. Great. Can't be worse than our past efforts.
Can't be worse. Before we started recording, I was commenting on your nice background. I really like it. Obviously, this podcast is audio only, so dear listener, Matt has a nice configuration of plants on the wall. You know, normally plants come out of the ground and they go upward, but these plants start on the wall and they go outward, which is a nice change to, perpendicular to the ground that you don't normally see.
I'm just subverting expectations.
Yeah. And I got this nice, map behind me that's relatively new, but what I didn't realize, Matt, is that, this map is glossy. And so you can probably see this big reflection right here, which I'm not happy about. Yeah. So I need to get a new non-glossy map. anyway, what have you been up to lately? Programming wise, anything you've been thinking about or doing lately that's interesting?
Well, I had a thought this morning, and I was going to just like record a little video about it, but then like the software that I used to record videos was not working. It so happens whenever you finally want to go like publish something and then the publishing software doesn't work.
But
we've been doing a project at work, and I was kind of thinking about this idea of Yagni, and like you ain't gonna need it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's like kind of dumb sometimes. And the specific situation that I was in was like we're adding some permissions to our product at work. So the current state of things is like users just have like an admin flag, and it's like true or false. And so if you're an admin, you can do certain things. And if you're not an admin, then you can't do certain things like within your account. And so we're moving to like, you know, the acronym for it is like RBAC, role-based access control. That's like the fancy enterprise way of saying this, but like users have roles and roles have permissions. And so, you know, a user has many permissions through the roles that they have. And so then we'll have like more granular permissions. So instead of, you know, saying that like only admins can do this thing, it's like, oh, if you have permission to like manage a project, then you can, you know, edit and delete projects instead of just saying, oh, only admins can delete it.
Mm-hmm.
So we were like starting to do this, and it's like, okay, I think you might hear people say like, oh, well, you should not build out like a really complicated permission system because you don't need it yet. Like only build like what your requirements currently are. But the problem that we have is that we actually have this like future end state that we know we need to have. Like we need to have a more complicated model eventually where like any organization can like make their own custom roles, and they can change what permissions go in the roles, and they can say like, what is the default permit, you know, role or permissions that people get when a new user is created and all this. And so like, we know we're going to do this. We just don't know when we're going to do this. It's more like a prioritization issue, right?
Yeah.
And so like, how do we balance that with not like over-engineering, but then also not like building such a bare bones system like right now for the current requirements, that then we have to have like an equally long effort to like go from like V1 to V2 and then like V2 to V3. So that's what I've been like thinking through the past week here.
Yeah. Well, I think about those things in terms of bets. Like, if you have an anticipated future need, you can do one of two things. You can make a bet that you're going to have that future need, and so build that more expensive version of the feature or whatever right now. Or you can make the bet that, well, you can make the bet that you're never going to need that thing, and so
yeah,
don't build the more expensive thing. Or you can like be agnostic and like make the bet that it's going to cost less overall. Well, no, it's like, okay, let me put it a different way. So building the more sophisticated version of the thing is more expensive upfront, but then the part people think about less maybe is that there's an ongoing cost to that. Because every time you have to make a change in that area, or every time you have to look at that area and understand it, there's a cost incurred.
Right.
And so basically when you do that, you're saying, I'm making a bet that this additional cost is going to be worth it because eventually we're going to need this thing. And you might be right or you might be wrong. Or you can build the less sophisticated version of the thing and it won't incur such a cost. But mm-hmm. then the way to lose that bet is if you eventually do end up needing that thing, and then you have right. to code the more sophisticated thing, and then there's waste or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. You didn't get any like savings.
Yeah.
From like doing a little bit of upfront like planning to be like, we know kind of where this is going to go.
Right. And my belief is that, you know, you're not always going to know, you're not always going to bet correctly, obviously. But as a policy, you win more of the time when you have a policy of betting that you're not going to need the thing than a policy of betting that you are going to need the thing, which I think is yeah. true. But that's not the same thing as like, to your point there, you like intelligently thought about the future and you're like, well, actually there is a very high likelihood, or maybe even just a known fact, that we are going right. to need this thing. And so it's a really right. good bet to build a more sophisticated version from the outset.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of subtlety and like judgment to it as well, of like knowing what is going to be easy to add on later, or what is like, what would be annoying if like we never actually do it. Like, because on the flip side, you could say like sometimes you make something like extremely customizable and generic, and then you never actually get to it, like we're saying, and then, you know, there's the ongoing like carrying cost of that feature. But yeah, and so I think like what I ended up landing on was sort of building out the, like leaving the data model and the mechanisms there to support like more rich customization, but just not actually exposing any of that to users yet. So mm-hmm. like we went ahead and like make all the join tables to like, you know, make an account can have many roles and roles can have many permissions and all that, and make it so that they are driven in the database, even though the first version, we're just going to say, like, to migrate people, it's just going to be like, all right, we're going to go in for every account and create a role called admin and a role called like member. And those are going to have the current permissions that are currently mapped to the, you know, the is admin flag. So like one way you could do this is like, oh, we could just like, you know, you could just kind of hard code in those particular roles. Or what I ended up doing was like, I'll just make them in the database. They just happen to have like a label field that is, you know, admin and member. But no one can sort of expose, those aren't exposed in the application yet. So no one can change them. And same thing for permissions. It's like, okay, an admin has 20 individual permissions. Right now, we'll just make, you know, 20 database rows for each of those permissions and set them up, even though no one can actually create or change or, you know, delete them. But when we, you know, down the line end up getting to this, then it's just like, oh, I just need to like almost just scaffold out like the admin page to be like, oh, yeah, now you can edit the name of this thing. And everything else would just work. So going from like the V2 to the V3 should be like a very small feature. And hopefully going from the V1 to the V2 is also like not as big because we're not doing the full thing. So I'm kind of like hoping that they'll end up being like equal size, even though we're kind of doing bigger steps in each one.
Yeah, I think that's a really smart way to do it. I think a relevant part of this picture, tell me if you agree with this, is that going to this RBAC way of doing the permissions from the less sophisticated way of just having like the isAdmin flag or whatever mm-hmm. other kind of permission system, it's a giant pain in the ass. And it's like definitely risky and time consuming and all that. So like that is certainly something to consider. Like if it's only a matter of like adding something and not having to change yeah. something that's already there, that's one thing. But like this isn't that. This is like completely migrating from one paradigm to another, and that's a much bigger deal.
Yeah. And I find actually that lots of software like projects within your job end up being this kind of like migration of stuff instead of like, you know, greenfield from scratch. How would you do this? And I think that's like somewhat challenging. Like a lot of resources and like educational materials will be like, oh, here's how you build like an authorization system in Rails. And it's like, this stuff is great, but it's also like not usually covered. Like, how do you migrate the existing, you know, system that like we don't have any, or we have, like you said, just a very primitive permission system. And some of that is, I don't know. I think some of that falls into like this weird bucket that I like to think of as like product engineering, where it's not just necessarily like the data schema or like writing the code, but it's also like, how do you actually roll out the feature? And rolling out the feature involves migrating existing data and thinking through like how our customer's going to react if like, oh, if we default them all to have no permissions, and either like, okay, the feature's done, like we support like this awesome new permission system. And you tell your customer that the first thing they do like Monday morning when they log in is like, they're going to go have to configure like 50 checkboxes for like all 200 users in their account. That's going to be a bad time.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I think a lot of organizations could stand to spend a lot more effort planning the rollout of projects. Cause like a lot of people plan the build out of projects, but then they don't plan how they're going to roll it out. And I mean both like exposing it to users and the mm-hmm. technical nuts and bolts of like getting it into production and stuff like that. Because all that stuff, like these migrations, the main thing that I think about, one of the main things, is just the risk, because there's usually a lot of risk involved. And so the big question for me is, how can I break this down and deploy it in small parts and mitigate the risk, but also like have everything make sense the entire time along the way. And then yeah. at the very end, we get the result that we want. Right. It goes a lot better if you like think about that stuff. From
if
the
you
beginning.
Had to like, or if you had to stop the project right here, like yes. are we in a bad state, or like, no, it's fine. We can stop and like postpone this for like 2 weeks if something else comes up, and then like we can go finish it.
Yeah.
A lot of these changes, even like the permission change that I'm talking about, it's like, kind of, it's sort of implicitly in what we said, but like the first thing we're doing is like okay, we need this new functionality in the system. To have that functionality, we need like a permissions data model that works like this. So But first, what we're doing is saying, let's take our current permission system and get it into a new, you know, permission system, and don't add any new features. So we're not adding any new roles. We're not changing how the permissions work. We're just getting everything over into the new like schema for things. Then we can pause. We can make sure that everything is like working. If there's any bugs, we can like iron that out before we, you know, had other like compounding changes. Then we can go and do the kind of the net new functionality, and hopefully it should be easy. It just reminds me a lot of the like Martin Fowler quote of like making the change easy. Do you know the one I'm talking about?
Like, yeah.
You can probably recite it better than I can.
Well, I don't like to correct people, but I feel like the correct attribution is important, is Kent Beck. And he said,
oh, Kent Beck, you're right.
Yeah, make the hard change easy, warning, this may be hard, and then make the easy change.
Yeah. So I think that's what we end up doing a lot in these bigger features is, you know, making it easy to add new permissions is what we would like to do, but the hard change is first like building a permission system and migrating the existing people, you know, into that.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, I think this is kind of implied in what you said, but like the idea of not mixing those two things together.
Right.
Yeah. Cause, if you mix those two things together, then like if it gets ripped out of your hands halfway through and you're like partway done with both those things and it's all mixed together, then you got nothing. But if you separate them and just do the underlying prep work first, get that completely deployed and tested and proven to be working and stuff like that, then if it gets ripped out of your hands partway through, at least you have something of value. And then when you pick back up, it'll be that much easier to pick up where you left off.
Yeah. So that's just a pattern that I've definitely been doing a lot of, you know, in the past like 18 months. So this is just a theme that like keeps popping back up in my work life is, you know, it is really like the Kent Beck saying, but it's more like on a macro scale instead of what I think the origins of that quote is like in like kind of a refactoring, like in the low level details of the code of like, oh, I want to make this change, make it easy. But I think it does, there's a nice quality to it that it does like still apply as you scale up and talk about things at like a whole feature level or, you know, bigger units of your product.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. These sorts of planning are very much not easy. And I don't know about you, but in my personal experience, very rarely actually done all that well.
Yeah. I think it can be tricky too, because sometimes it does seem like it's like taking longer or I don't know. I think there is also just the natural inclination of people to not want to like over engineer something or not want to like pause in the intermediate. They kind of just want to get to the end.
Yeah. Yeah. And unfortunately, it's like a mistake. It's like a false economy. People are like, oh, let's not bother with all that stuff. We want to go fast. It's like, no, all that stuff is exactly how you go fast. It's like the, oh, don't worry about doing it right. Just like get it out there the fast way. It's like, well,
yeah.
The reason we call the good code good is because it's fast. Like that's the thing we want. Like that's what's good about it.
There's like another phrase that I like that I think captures this. It's like slow is smooth and smooth is fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good one. And these things can be hard to teach because there's like so many nuances, and good luck coming up with an example. This is one of the places ChatGPT shines, because like for authors who need to contrive examples but mm-hmm. you don't want to try to think of something, like ChatGPT is so much better at thinking of these imaginary scenarios. But like reality is so complex and there's so many parts that like to convey this stuff in a book or video or whatever, it's just kind of not realistic.
Yeah. Yeah, I struggle a lot too, just knowing like what is the best like mechanism to like share that learning. It's like a lot of it is so situational, and it also needs to hit you like at the exact like right time for you the lesson to like really sink in, right? Like if you're not in a context where you're working on like an existing application, or if you're not being tasked with work that specifically involves like making big changes and caring about, you know, like migrating the stuff, it's like it doesn't really resonate with you.
Exactly.
It's certainly not something that is going to make like for a very like enticing, like clickbaity, like YouTube video, or like a short little like tweet. But it's like has like, I don't know, like it's probably one of the most like important things you can learn in being like a product type engineer is this kind of stuff. And it has really big, like it can have a big benefit to your career. You probably just have to learn the lesson from experience.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully you can learn it from somebody else's experience rather than going through your own painful experience. This is one of the reasons why programming is so hard to learn and takes so long to learn, because most educational content for programmers is beginner content. There's a few different forces that result in that being the case. Like, one is it's the easiest stuff to teach. For people who don't know anything at all, like almost anything you can teach them is good. And there's not like a bunch of baggage and context and stuff like that. So that's relatively easy to teach. And then there are a lot of beginners compared to how many intermediate and expert people there are. And the needs and wants, the learning needs and wants of intermediate and advanced people are like way more diverse. Like the chances that you'll create something that's like interesting broadly to intermediate people is like so much less. That's why there's so many like beginner tutorials for such and such language. It's like that's so much broader interest than like, here's exactly how you set up Docker for a Rails application or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I have tons of these things just in the past, like 2 years at this job that I've learned. Like I learned so much about like how to like deeply integrate with a third party, like API that involves like data syncing. And it's like, there's all these different considerations you should think about around doing work in background jobs and caching and, separating your queues and being resilient against API errors, and even like non-technical things about like how should you like be a good like partner application for this third party API, and like how do you influence and like gain the ability to have an impact on like the product roadmap, and like if there's APIs that are missing, like how do you like advocate and like get those APIs added to the platform so that you can like reduce code on your end? Like, it's like, that's like super valuable, but it's like, how do you package that up into like, a consumable, like educational product to like sell to somebody is quite challenging.
Yeah. Like the reward isn't big enough proportionate to the work. Like, And not just necessarily like monetary reward, but like,
well, the audience too is just so much smaller, right? It's like, if you're not building that type of system, then the value of the course is like pretty low. But if you are, it's like super high. And so, you know, would someone, you know, a company would probably be like, oh, we'd pay $50,000 for like the hard fought lessons of this, because it's going to save us so much time. And if the company doesn't have that, then they're like, I'm going to feel bad about paying like $9 for this thing, 'cause I'm never going to actually do it.
Yeah. Right. I've thought about that so many times, how there's like so many things that don't exist and probably never will exist just because there aren't strong enough incentives to make somebody want to create that thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, at some point too, like you said, you know, just the, there's not enough of a reward to it of, you know, like you could probably get more monetary reward just like being a consultant that does these types of things versus, you know, trying to teach other people how to be a consultant that does these type of things.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Cause there are like, there's so many like books that I feel like should exist, but again, there's not a strong enough incentive for them to exist. And so nobody's going to write that book, like the book about how to integrate with a third party API. That would be a great book for some people, but Matt, I don't think you're going to write that book. I'm not going to write that book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It does seem like it is becoming like, it's certainly easier today than it was 20 years ago to like get that book written or like at least get that like knowledge shared with people. It's like before you'd have to like go to a major publisher to like make a dead, you know, a dead tree programming book that is going to show up at like the bookstore. And they're like, yeah, you know, great proposal, but you know, there's like maybe only like 500 people in the world that are, you know, the target audience for this book. And, so that was hard, but now you could, you know, conceivably, you know, I could start a blog that is like, you know, Rails third party API integrations.com and I could collect a mailing list with, you know, and maybe I could capture, you know, 300 of the 500 people in the world that are like interested in that topic and, at least get, you know, get the material to them.
So dear listener, one of the takeaways I was intending for this is if you find yourself, cause I see this question a lot. If you find yourself frustrated that there's not like intermediate level educational material out there, it's not just that the world is being inconsiderate to you. Those are the reasons why that stuff doesn't exist.
Yeah, I think ultimately like people respond to incentives. And so if the incentives are there, then we'll get more of it. And if they're not, there'll be, you know, less of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And something, well, that's kind of something I'm hoping to convey in my weekly meetups that I do is like some of that more intermediate type stuff, because given the fact that it happens every week, there can be some continuity to it, and it's like an interactive format where people can ask questions and stuff like that. That's my hope with that. That's not like the ultimate. I've like for years I've like been trying to think of like, how do I help people get from like, I don't know, junior to senior, whatever that might mean, in a way that's like doable for them and doable for me. Mm-hmm. I haven't gotten there yet, but it seems like that's something a lot of people could benefit from.
Yeah. Something that I think is like interesting that I think about a lot is, trying to find the sweet spot in terms of like the effort to like produce some content that, you know, teaches something and like what the value of it is. Cause I think there's different ways to share that kind of information. And some of them just take more time than others. Right. Like if I were to like, we can, you know, spitball on this, like integrating third party API thing. If I were to make like a highly polished, like, you know, screencast series where I walk you through this with like real examples, like this would take probably hundreds of hours to do. And, you know, it would, you know, if that's like the highest quality, best like mechanism to transfer as much of this knowledge as I think is possible, like that's on one end. Then on the other end, there's like, you know, this podcast, right now it's kind of like a one-to-one of like, we sit and record for, you know, 30 minutes and then we've like produced 30 minutes of content, you know, plus or minus, you know, 5 minutes for editing out, you know, when my dog is barking or something. But the quality and like the amount of data transfer is going to be like a lot less, right? So maybe it's enough that someone just heard me say earlier, like, oh, you should think about, you know, data access patterns and, you know, queue systems and caching and like, even like, oh, that was a novel insight to think about, like my job is integrating with a third party API to include, like, I should probably network with people that work at the company building the API. So if I need, you know, a new field, I can like have a reasonable chance of getting it added. Like maybe that's like enough, of an insight that we got just from, you know, me saying it twice now here in audio form, that has an impact. So then there's somewhere in between of like, well, maybe I don't need to do like a super polished, you know, video course. Maybe you could do like, you know, a single blog post. Maybe that can get you like the 80-20. So I don't know. I just think it's interesting thinking about the different mediums for sharing some of this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's hard to know what's helpful and stuff. You know, there's the time it takes to create the thing, but there's also like the certainty level that it's going to be helpful to anybody or pay off for the person making it. Because that, speaking for myself at least, and I'm sure I'm not unique in this, is like I'm very hesitant to create something if I think there's not a high chance that it's going to be worth my time. And again, that's not necessarily monetary. Like if I create something that ends up not being helpful to hardly anybody, then like that's a huge bummer. But if I create something, you know, even just like a blog post or something like that, mm-hmm. and a lot of people seem helped by it, then like that just gives me some nice dopamine hits. But like, if I don't have any reason to believe it's going to help a lot of people, I'm not even going to go down that path in the first place.
Yeah. I've heard from other people that, and my brain doesn't really work like this, but their brains work in such a way where like they just have to like get some of this stuff out of their brain and like onto paper. And so even if no one reads it or no one benefits from it, it like is a good exercise for them in, you know, kind of just dumping their thoughts or, you know, sharpening their positions. I guess I'm curious if that's something that you find yourself doing ever?
Absolutely. That drives a lot of my stuff. Like I wrote this really long blog post just on the topic of duplication, because I feel like so many people are so wrong about duplication and it's like harming the industry. And so I'm mm-hmm. like, I gotta get my thoughts out there because I'm right and they're wrong and people need to know what's right. And so I didn't write it because I necessarily thought anybody would read it. I just wrote it because I needed to write it.
Yeah. There's probably some deeper discussion around like, you know, creating for like creating art versus, you know, creating content that we, you know, are intending to, you know, measure like measure the ROI on and determine if it is worth our time.
Yeah. Yeah. And a happy coincidence is that a lot of the time, if you create something, you just feel driven to create, even if you're not creating it for someone else. Those things sometimes even more than other things are the things that resonate with other people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. I think it's probably time to start heading toward a conclusion pretty soon, but I want to bring up something that I came across earlier today. And this is one of those things, Matt, that's going to trigger me to write something just because I need to get my own opinion about it. But I read this quote. It was like a quote of a quote. Somebody said that Bob Martin said that testing is about specification, not verification. And this is something I've been thinking about a lot recently. As I look at a lot of people's tests, I see that the tests are phrased in terms of it does such and such correctly. Mm-hmm. Like they'll visit some page and like in this test, it'll like assert that like these seven different things work correctly. And it's right. Very clear that they're in the like verification mindset, not the specification mindset. And I struggled for so long to find the words. And not surprisingly, that thought I had was not an original thought. Apparently, Bob Martin had that thought. And I was talking with one of my consulting clients the other day, and he said that he used to think of the code as being the main thing and the tests as being something extra. But now he thinks of the tests as being the main thing, and the code is like subordinate to that. That's you know, paraphrasing what he said.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I went and Googled this Bob Martin testing is about specification, not verification. And I found this Reddit post about it. And bear with me a second. I have it up in another tab. Oh, yeah. This is so... There are so many comments that bother me so deeply, Matt. Here's the most upvoted comment. I never understood TDD for initial development. However, I love TDD for fixing bugs. Write a test to replicate the bug, red, fix the bug, green, make any tweaks to your fix, refactor. And dear listener and Matt, I'll spare you my whole rant about this comment. But just to let you know what I'm thinking about it, like, how would you write tests just for occasional bugs you come across if you don't have like all the foundational stuff that comes as a natural result of writing tests for things in general? Because if you've ever been in a code base where like there's very low test coverage, but then you have to write a test for like some bug or something like that, it's like you're at the peak of a mountain, but the entire base of the mountain below the peak doesn't exist. And so you have to spend like days and weeks like building up the base of this mountain before you can be at the peak of the mountain.
Yeah.
So that makes very little sense to me. Anyway, that's one thing that triggers that kind of rant for me.
Yeah, it's basically like if you like working in a system where it's easy for you to just write a small test to verify that a bug is fixed, it seems like you would also like doing that as your normal development workflow for new features instead of only for bugs.
Yeah.
Is that kind of the thesis of it, of your take?
Not exactly, but what you said is definitely consistent with the way I was viewing that thing. And I guess it's like, I don't have any contempt for the person who wrote that. I'm not mad at them. It's just so disappointing that they're misunderstanding the point of testing so completely.
Yeah. Well, it's difficult with all these concepts too. I mean, the thing I always think about is, and I hope I sourced this one correctly, because I think this was also Kent Beck had sort of, when he was working at Facebook, he basically said like, you know, tests are great, but like you get paid to write code, not write tests. And I think people took that as an argument that like, oh, tests are bad, tests are worthless, blah, blah, blah. And I think it was, I like having that perspective from Kent, because I think to me, tests always are like a means to an end. So I think for me, I've found that tests are most valuable when they are giving you confidence that the code is working, and like they themselves are not the value. It's that like more abstract thing of like having the confidence that the code is working, but ultimately like users are running the code and users are not running, you know, the tests, and users are like what you're trying to deliver value to.
Hmm. Well, this is a hell of a can of worms, because like going to the root of it, it's like, what do we get paid for as programmers? I'm not sure that I agree that we get paid to write code. We get paid to build and maintain systems. And not just we get paid to build and maintain systems, but we get paid to build and maintain systems and keep the cost of maintaining those systems to a reasonable level as the system grows and as time passes and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And that's like a much more complicated job. Like there's so much more to that than just writing code.
Sure.
Yeah. And to me, like tests are such a huge part of keeping that maintenance cost reasonable. We could like discuss that topic for many, many hours, but yeah, I don't know if I agree with Kent Beck on that one.
Yeah, I think it's always I always come back to that particular quote too, because to me it was just, I think there's an interesting context there of like, someone who was sort of an agile, like kind of coach, sort of like I don't know if like philosopher is like the right word, but like someone who sort of was, from my understanding, was kind of just writing generally about these practices. And then like he ended up working at Facebook, where it's sort of like the opposite, like philosophically, right? That's like, you know, move fast, break things. You know, if it makes money, you know, great. If it doesn't make money, like, you know, kill the project or whatever. And so I just thought that was an interesting one-liner and something to think about. I'm sure the truth is like always somewhere in the middle.
Yeah. You know, interestingly, my friend TJ Stankus recently told me, I didn't know about this, but Mark Zuckerberg actually recanted the move fast and break things phrase that he said, which makes a lot of sense because like breaking things isn't fast. If you have to break things and then fix those things, that makes things go pretty slow. But like, it's like that saying, a lie can travel around the world before the truth, or no, well, the truth is still lacing up its boots or whatever. Move fast and break things got so ubiquitous, but then we never heard about the recantation.
Right. I mean, you can see that play out all the time in, even just in programming these days. I mean, I saw on Twitter this morning that it's been like 1 month since there was the like big Rails Hotwire TypeScript drama. And it's like 1 month ago, everyone got very mad about this thing. Lots of like very strong opinions were like shouted out into the world. And it's like, okay, is anyone going back to like revisit, you know, if any of these proclamations like were true, or you know, what's the current state of things once the, you know, the fur died down a little bit?
Yeah, you know, I read this thing, maybe it was in that book Thinking Fast and Slow, but like it said something about the news and how the news is not successful, or not the news isn't effective in telling people what to think. But it is, I'm butchering the wording of this, but like the news doesn't tell people what to think, but it does tell people what to think about. Mm. Or it gets people to think about what the news is about. For some reason, I can't get the words out, but hopefully you know what I mean. And I feel like it's that way with Twitter so much, and just programming news in general. Like,
yeah.
Those trends are so effective in getting people to think about a specific thing. And I feel like people should be more judicious about how they spend their time thinking about things. Like, just because it's the current issue of the day, like, is that actually a worthwhile thing to think about? It would be only by coincidence if the hot issue of the day is something worthwhile to think about.
Yeah, like are you getting pulled into discussions or asked to like give your opinion on something because it is like of the moment, like in the zeitgeist of whatever, like, you know, the Twitter algorithm has decided is, you know, getting engagement today. And can you really truly give a useful opinion before the wave has moved on to something else?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I'd rather like spend my time reading in like a 20-year-old book than somebody's tweets. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause like even in this case, I would say like probably the more interesting thing about this whole like removing TypeScript from a library thing would be like, all right, we're going to do this. Then we're going to like check back in 6 months and see like what impact this actually had. But that's like not a time horizon that anyone is like interested in discussing on Twitter, right? So it's like, you know, 1 hour after this change is done, you have people talking about how this is going to have like, you know, long lasting impact and all these, both for and against. I mean, I think you can make arguments that on both sides of the issue that I think are worthwhile, but like, you know, no one's actually going to revisit this. You can see this a lot too, like, just on social media in general, if somebody posts like something that becomes like popular but is wrong, and then even if they like post a correction to it, it's like the original one has like 1 million views, and then like the correction where it's like, oh guys, actually I was wrong, I made a mistake here, it's like that has like, you know, 25,000 views.
Oh yeah, Yeah, and like another trap is like when somebody posts like a really stupid take or something like that, and then a bazillion people feel obligated to respond to it. And it's like, just if there's some bozo who's wrong, just let them be wrong. There's not really any profit in jumping on this thing and correcting it. Again, it's like that thing of being really, really impressionable on what you should spend your time thinking about.
Yeah. It's really tough to do that, though, I think, because it's like, you know, it's natural, I think, for people to want to like correct an error or chime in and you know, and say you're wrong.
I'm just as susceptible to it as anybody else. And it takes me great effort when I see something that's very wrong to hold back and not say anything about it. Something that helps me is when I remind myself of that XKCD comic, which maybe you've seen, Matt. It's like this couple, and the man's on the computer, and the wife is like, "Honey, are you coming to bed?" And he's like, "No, honey, this is important. Somebody on the internet is wrong."
Yeah.
And classic. I don't want to be that guy on the computer.
I think that's a good goal to aspire to.
And that's maybe a good place to leave it for today. Matt, if anybody wants to find your stuff online and that kind of thing, where should they go?
Yeah, you can probably most easily find me on Twitter. My handle is _Swanson. And you can find plenty of examples of me, you know, doing all the things that I just spent 35 minutes railing against, being wrong and clickbaity and all that good stuff.
Probably me too. And we'll put that stuff in the show notes, of course. And Matt, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, as always.